Recognizing the symptoms of a stroke and acting fast can make a big difference for someone having a stroke. Hi, I'm Jill Nadeau, filling in for Larry Miller today on the Ideas Network. We're going to find out what to do if you think someone is having a stroke, and also talk about treatments and prevention with our two guests. They are Dr. Luke Bradbury. He is back in the studio with us, and he is a stroke neurologist at UW Health, and Nikki Bennett. She's a registered nurse and the stroke program coordinator at UW Health. And as always, your questions are very welcome. So give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email. That address is ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Bradbury, it's so good to see you again.
Thanks so much for having me back.
You bet. And Nikki, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. We always like to talk about this once a year. Mm-hmm. May is Stroke Awareness Month. Yeah. First, let's just talk, what is a stroke? Let's just do basics.
Yeah, it's always great to define what it is we're talking about when we use a stroke, the term stroke. And so there's sort of two big classes of stroke that we talk about. One is a bleeding type stroke or hemorrhagic stroke. And that's, you know, probably anywhere from 15 to 20% of the strokes that happen. And that's where a blood vessel inside the skull breaks open and there's bleeding into or around the brain. The other type is an ischemic stroke or where there's lack of blood flow to a particular part of the brain. Now, there's a lot of different reasons that can happen. Maybe a clot can form in the heart and go up to the brain and block the blood flow. Or maybe inside the brain, there can be a little formation of a clot in a small blood vessel that also blocks flow and then causes stroke symptoms. And so what people will experience is what we call acute, sort of sudden onset focal neurological deficits. And what that means in more accessible terms, is that someone will suddenly have things like weakness, numbness, trouble with their vision, trouble talking, where the nervous system isn't working right, and it happens very quickly. And often for strokes, the severity is maximal at onset. So it's as bad as it is right when it starts. And so we want to get the word out that if you're experiencing any of those symptoms, that you call 911 and go to the hospital right away, because a lot of the stroke treatments we have are very time dependent. In other words, we need to get the patient to our emergency department, do some workup, some usually often brain scans and maybe some laboratory tests. And if we see that a stroke is happening, we have treatments, but they have to happen as soon as we can get them started in order to help make them more effective and also make them less risky. And so the acronym that people can remember that will help people know or at least suspect they might be having a stroke is BEFAST, B-E-F-A-S-T. And what that stands for is balance, eyes, face, arm, speech, and then time. And to go through those real quickly, B for balance, if you suddenly have trouble with your balance, your sense of balance, trouble walking, go call 911 right away, go to the hospital. Eyes, if you have double vision or blind spots or trouble, sudden onset, you know, trouble with your vision. And then F for face, if you have facial weakness or a droopy face, someone notices that, you know, your face doesn't look as strong on one side or the other. Speech, if you're slurring your words or you have language trouble, you can't express or understand what people are saying to you. That's BEFAS. And then T is time to call 911. So if you're experiencing any of those symptoms, call 911 and go to the hospital. And then what I always tell my patients too is, if you're just not sure, maybe it doesn't fit perfectly. You're having symptoms that don't fit perfectly in that acronym, that BEFAST acronym. I don't mind going to the emergency department and telling people they haven't had a stroke. So it's okay to call, come in, get checked out, and we can make sure you're doing okay. But it's really important to go and be seen by experts so that we can help. In case there is a stroke, we can help you get better.
And even if it isn't a stroke, you have symptoms. So there's
something
wrong.
It might be something else that's very important to know about early on so it can be treated if it's not a stroke. It's a great point.
Okay, great. Now, Nikki, you work for the stroke center, right? Tell us what happens there and what your job is there.
Sure. I am the stroke program coordinator. So my role is to really make sure that we have a great team of providers that meet our patients in the ED, and we expedite their stroke care and give them the best treatment that we can, not only right when they get into the ED, but all the way through hospitalization and discharge. And then the other cool thing about my position is that I do a lot of education. So nursing education and then community education like this. So getting the words out about signs and symptoms of stroke and the importance of calling 911 when you're having those signs and symptoms and coming in right away, not waiting until those symptoms may go away or get worse, but really coming in right away.
Okay. And Dr. Bradbury, what are some of the things that will happen to someone when they go into the emergency department?
So one of the reasons we ask people to call 911 is what can happen even before they get to the emergency department is the ambulance crew are trained in how to recognize the symptoms of a stroke. And so what they can do is call ahead and get the emergency department ready. So we call that a pre-hospital notification. So I might get a page while a patient is still at home and the ambulance is getting ready to bring them in that they're on the way and it could be a stroke. And so what happens is they'll hit the emergency room door and it often goes straight to the CT scanner. And that's so that we can do a scan of the brain, look for bleeding, so it might be a bleeding type stroke, and also look for early signs of ischemic stroke where, you know, there's a blood clot blockage. Very often now we're also going to get a scan that involves the blood vessels. We look at the blood vessels in the head and the neck to look for blockages and other problems, maybe even arterial damage from cholesterol buildup and things like that. And once we get that scan, we'll have an idea of whether we can give acute treatment. And that right now is still one of the primary treatments we give is an IV medicine called TPA. And that's what people have referred to as the clot-busting medicine. And so if someone is within the right time period, they get there early enough, and they have symptoms that are consistent with stroke and the scans look like it's safe enough, we might give the medicine in the vein to try and break up a blood clot, restore blood flow, and then hopefully get them better. And now for the last couple of years, there's been a lot more advanced treatment where if we see a big blood clot that's blocking an artery in the brain or the neck, we have excellent surgeons and endovascular specialists who can actually use – it's similar to how people have stents put in their heart. But instead of going down to the heart, they go up into the brain and can try and remove that blood clot mechanically. And that's – the technical term is a mechanical thrombectomy where we pull that blood clot out of the artery, restore blood flow, and people can get a lot better quickly. Again, it's very time dependent. So those are some of the things that can happen when someone arrives to the emergency department. And then a lot of it, too, is we have to review their medicines and we have to look and examine the patient and do all that stuff. So a lot happens really quick when you arrive there, but the main things are scans and a medical evaluation by the doctors and nurses.
So that's another good reason why they should call 911 mm-hmm. and not go in themselves.
Sometimes people have mild symptoms and mm-hmm. they think, oh, I can maybe just drive in and get seen quickly. And sometimes, you know, symptoms, while I said they are usually worse when they start, they can sometimes start and then get worse over the next couple of minutes or even, you know, 10 or 15 minutes. And so you could be in the car when suddenly your weakness gets worse and you have trouble controlling your vehicle. Mm-hmm. But it is really important to get that pre-hospital notification. And so that's why we do ask to call 911 so that they can help us with that.
Okay. Well, let's go to the phones because we've got a couple of people waiting. If you have a question for our experts, 1-800-642-1234. And of course, you can always email us. It's ideas@wpr.org. So our first caller is Margie, and she's in Milwaukee. Hi, Margie. What's your question?
Hi. I have a question regarding the pons area. I'm 65 years old, and probably 12 or 15 years ago, I had an MRI for a reason for a nerve scan kind of question. And it came back normal for all those concerns, but it said one of the impressions was that there was mild ischemic changes in the pons area. And everybody said just not to worry about that. That was, it was kind of a side note. Well, in the last 10 years, I've had maybe 5 episodes of vertigo and intense vertigo where I'm down on the ground and within minutes I start vomiting and I'm probably out of it for 6 to 8 hours. But it only happens every couple of years. And now I've developed some swallowing issues and they said I have a vocal cord dysfunction. And I'm just wondering, is any of that possibly related?
Right. So to talk about the pons real quickly, that's part of the brainstem. So when we think of the brain, there's sort of the overlying cerebral hemispheres. Those are the big top parts of the brain. And then on the base of the brain is the brainstem. And all of the nerve information that's happening up in the higher cerebral hemispheres funnels down through the brainstem and the pons, you know, as part of that to go out to the whole body. So it's a very important part of the brain, a very critical thing. And when it's hard to know exactly without having seen your scan, it's hard for me to speak a lot to exactly what they meant. But often we'll see in various parts of the brain what we call small vessel ischemic changes. And those aren't exactly strokes, but they are a sign of like maybe the blood flow was a little tenuous in those areas from time to time. And so that could be what they were talking about on the PONS. I would say if you haven't had a good neurological evaluation or had a repeat scan to look again at what they were seeing in the PONS, it might be worth talking to your doctor and seeing if you can see a neurologist so they can examine you and see. And sometimes we'll see things on an MRI scan or a CT scan that I'll have to exactly sure what the diagnosis is, but I need to repeat that scan after a period of time so I can see how things have changed. And then that will help a lot. And then hearing your story and doing a good neurological exam would also be helpful. So it could be that, some of the vertigo you're experiencing, the vocal cord problems, could sometimes be problems with the PON. So it's probably worth talking with your doctor and having them, check that out. To see if anything else needs to be done right now. Although another thing that's very common is peripheral vertigo. And this is something that people come in to be evaluated for stroke often. And what that is in the inner ear balance centers, people can suddenly become very vertiginous. They have a strong sensation of spinning or tilting. And it also really upsets your stomach. You get a really severe nausea with that sometimes. And sometimes we don't often know immediately, is that from the ear balance center or is that actually from the brain and the brain stem? And again, it takes sometimes some scans and a good history and physical exam to really know the difference. But if you've had problems kind of intermittently through the years, it might be worth seeing a neurologist to get that checked out again.
Okay, great. Thank you for the call, Margie. Next, let's go to Hollis in Verona. Hi, Hollis.
Hi. Yes, I have a comment and a question. My boyfriend, another half of 18 years, had a stroke. He was only 56 or 54. He's 56 now, but there was no history in his family of 19 children. Was there any stroke or heart problem? But he was a heavy smoker. And when he had the stroke, when I came home at 9 o'clock at night, that he said he was kind of dizzy, went out to have a cigarette in the garage, came back in, and he had complained about a headache. I'm like, well, he's had that before. So he sat down in the living room to eat, and he stood up. And he also said his lips were really tingling. He goes, well, I've never had that happen before. And I'm like, well, that's kind of different. But anyway, we started eating, and he stood up, and he started galloping across and just dropped on the living room floor. And he said, I think I had a stroke. So immediately I called 911. So he did get to the hospital, but he did quit smoking for. So that's why I wanted to tell people, too, for the signs of stroke. I just, because of his age, I thought, oh, he's not going to have a stroke. He's too young. And never thought about it until all that happened. And then the signs were there. I've never heard anybody with the numbness of the lips, but the headache and dizziness. But anyway, then he quit smoking for 7 months and started back up to a pack a day. So I know that. Here, all patients are different, and I just want the general consensus of another stroke happening once somebody starts smoking again, at least a pack a day or around there. So that's kind of my comment to let people know some of the signs to look for, because I'd never heard of the numbness of the lips. And then, getting him to the emergency room, he had like 7 minutes to get that special.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Okay. Well, thank you, Hollis. What is that? The smoking? I mean, that's really bad.
Thanks for calling in. Thanks for bringing that up, because smoking is such a huge risk factor for stroke. And, when we talk about the dangers of cigarette smoking, a lot of the time people think of cancer and other things like that. But really, when you inhale all of those chemicals that are made by burning the tobacco and then putting it in your lungs, they circulate in your blood as well, all of those dangerous chemicals. And what they can do is damage the arteries. And that's why people are also at a higher risk of heart attacks and strokes if they smoke. And really, there's no safe amount of stroking. So less is always better. But if, to really reduce and try and continue to reduce your risk of repeat strokes and heart attacks, you need to quit smoking entirely. But that's really hard to do. A lot of my patients have a really tough time. And so, again, talk with your primary doctor, talk with your stroke specialist or other doctors about how they can help you quit smoking. And sometimes it's medicine, sometimes it's counseling, sometimes it's nicotine patches or gum. But there's a lot of different ways, and everyone has to find their own way of going about doing it. But to address your kind of question about recurrence, really any smoking at all, but certainly a pack a day, is going to, again, increase that risk of another stroke. So keep on working with him. I know it's hard, but hopefully he'll be able to quit again and continue to reduce it. And after you quit, as time goes on, your risk goes down and down and down. So it's really important to quit and stay off the tobacco to help reduce your risks.
Okay, great. Thank you, Hollis, very much. We appreciate your contribution. Let's go now to Joe in Sauk County. Hi, Joe. What's your question?
Hi. My father died at a very early age, and this is back in the late 60s, of cerebral hemorrhage. And I've always been confused. I understand it's a hemorrhage in the cerebrum, but I've always been confused. What's the difference between that and what I hear others describe as a massive stroke?
Yeah, and I would say that's a great question. The term massive stroke could mean a lot of different things. It basically could be a very large, you know, blood clot stroke, or it could be a very large hemorrhage. And so that's when people tell me that's what they had in the past, I always have to really clarify with them what that means. And the other thing is, within the family of hemorrhages, there's lots of different kinds of bleeding that can happen in the brain. It can happen in the body of the brain, you know, deep inside of it. It can also happen between the brain and the skull. A lot of times people have aneurysms that they don't know about. And when an aneurysm in the brain, which is sort of a weakened blood vessel, when that breaks open, you get what we call a subarachnoid hemorrhage, again, bleeding between the brain and the skull. That can be very dangerous too. And so there's a lot of different kinds of bleeding in the brain that can happen. And sometimes it does run in families. So you do have to, you know, make sure you talk to your doctor about your family history. Smoking is another risk factor for hemorrhages, so don't smoke. Watch your blood pressure. That's a really important thing to be careful. If you have a family history of strokes of any kind, you really have to watch your blood pressure carefully and make sure if it's high that it gets treated. But there's a lot of different kinds of hemorrhages that can happen. And some of them are fairly mild and some of them can be really devastating. But it depends on how much bleeding happens inside the brain like that.
Okay. Thanks for that question, Joe. We're talking about strokes with Dr. Luke Bradbury, a stroke neurologist at UW Health, and Nikki Bennett, the stroke program coordinator at UW Health. Our on-air production team today is Jane Rotunda on phones and Nigel O'Shea on the board. What questions do you have about strokes? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Coming up at 11:45, we'll be talking about the latest Dave Kubiak Door County mystery book with author Patricia Skulka. Hope you can stay with us for that. But right now, we're talking about how to recognize and treat a stroke with our guests. And we've got a couple of calls waiting, but we've got some open lines. The number 1-800-642-1234. And of course, you can always email us ideas@wpr.org. Now, Nikki, why don't you talk a little bit about what your program does for people, some of the support groups and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a couple of upcoming things going on. So we sponsor Stroke Camp, which we partner with Refresh and Retreat Stroke Camp, which is a national organization. A woman by the name of Mary Lee formed that back in 2004 and started with a single camp, and now they have over 35 across the United States, and we are lucky to be partnering with them and offering Stroke Camp for our stroke survivors and caregivers. It's up in Green Lake in September, so registration for that opens next week already. So we're excited to be offering it. So I kind of joke it's Stroke Camp, but it's a bit more like glamping in that it's in a convention center. So you're staying in a hotel,
okay.
And we have a great place that provides meals, and we have this great convention center. But we do all kinds of things. We have boat rides and different support groups and different educational sessions, time to just relax and be pampered, and it's just a really great time for our stroke survivors to get out and meet other survivors and really just have a great weekend.
And where can people find out more about that?
Yeah, you can go to strokecamp.org.
Okay.
We are kind of in the middle of the page right now in terms of registration, and then we also have information on our UW Health Stroke website that you can go to as well.
What kind of information will people find that, the stroke website?
Yeah. Yeah, we have all kinds of different things on there. So we have, as Dr. Bradbury was talking about, just the difference between the types of strokes that are out there. We have our providers that are listed, and then we also have signs and symptoms of stroke and things you can do to prevent a stroke. So all kinds of different educational materials out there to read
and
about.
We do have a link to that page on our program note. So if you go to WPR/Larry and look for today's show, you will see a link to that. So you
Great.
Can find out more information. Now let's go back to the phone because the lines are all full. Holly in Ogema? Holly?
Yeah.
Is that right? Ogema?
Ogema.
Okay, sure.
North Central Wisconsin.
Sounds good, Holly. What can we help you with today?
Okay, my husband, a few years back, I came home from hauling mail, and his eyes were going rapidly back and forth like I'd never seen them before. And we went into the emergency ward, and he spent a weekend in the hospital, and they said he probably had a TIA, but that it was inconclusive, and he has very high cholesterol, and they put him on Crestor, and the hard part we're dealing with is his muscles hurt so bad that he's practically incapacitated after the Crestor. And then we played with some other stuff, but he's just very miserable in his muscles. Where do we go from here?
So a TIA, and thanks for calling. That's an important thing to talk about when we talk about stroke. A TIA stands for transient ischemic attack. And what that is, as far as we can tell, is where there might be a brief interruption of blood flow to a part of the brain that is then restored, and so there's no damage left. But for a period of time, a patient will have stroke symptoms, but there's no damage left over, and so the brain recovers. And we think of it a warning sign for stroke. So it, there may be risk factors for stroke, and there was just a brief time where the flow wasn't great. And so we want to address those risk factors and try and prevent a stroke going forward. As a quick aside, they used to use the term mini stroke, and we're trying to move away from that because when someone uses the term mini stroke, I'm not exactly sure, do they mean a very small stroke or do they mean a TIA? It's not very clear. But a TIA, usually there's no damage done in the brain. Well, by definition, there's no damage done in the brain. And so high cholesterol is a big risk factor for stroke. It's something that we try and treat all the time. Those medicines, so Crestor is in the family of medicines called statins, and those statin medicines can sometimes cause really painful muscle cramping and other problems for people, and it's an intolerance. It's not really an allergic reaction, but it's an intolerance. It means that patient probably cannot continue to take that medicine, and they need to find an alternative. And so if you're, I hope your husband should keep talking with his primary doctor and checking cholesterols, and there's obviously a lot of lifestyle modifications to make too regarding diet and exercise and things like that. But if the muscle pain is too bad, sometimes patients can't take those statin-type medicines. There are alternatives out there. And in fact, just recently, I think in the last couple of years, newer medicines have come out that are different than the statins but can also be very effective in treating cholesterol medicine. So ask your doctor if he hasn't tried those. It might be a good option to help reduce your cholesterol levels and prevent another TIA and stroke. And of course, again, back to blood pressure and smoking, all the other risk factors, you have to keep an eye on those too.
Great. Well, thank you, Holly, for that call. Next up, we have Mary in La Crosse. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Okay, full disclosure, I'm a retired stroke coordinator, and I am calling, first of all, to say I think, of course, it's never a good time to have a stroke, but it's an absolutely amazing time to be working in stroke compared to where it was 15 years ago. And from personal experience, I want to thank you guys because I know how hard you are working. I know how hard it is because it touches almost every part of a health system that you could imagine. And the word stroke comes up and they want you to address it. I want people to understand how devoted the people who work in stroke are. I really was never so heartened by the camaraderie that I experienced in the stroke community with other stroke coordinators, with physicians like yourself, willing to devote their time and energy to stroke. So that's just my shout out. Thank you so much. And keep up the good work.
Oh, and thank you, Mary, for the work that you've done. Do you find that is the case, Nikki?
Oh, it's so true. I can totally relate. It really is the team that we work with that makes our program so successful. And you really have to reach out to all areas of the hospital, as well as the community in terms of EMS, out to rehab and outpatient therapy. But it really takes a village to keep this program running and dedicated people to do that. And we're lucky to have a great team here as well. And it sounds like you did as well.
So UW has this great team. I would assume most larger cities do. What about in smaller rural areas? Is that something that is maybe missing there, or is that everywhere?
It's hard. In a lot of smaller hospitals, they will see some stroke patients throughout the year. And what we try and help them set up is a good connection with major stroke centers. And it isn't just UW. There's other fantastic stroke centers just here in Madison. Both St. Mary's and Meritor are primary stroke centers, and they have excellent doctors and treatments there. And so we try and connect in very meaningful ways with smaller, more rural hospitals so that if someone shows up to that emergency department with stroke symptoms, they call us as soon as they can, and we can help them either transfer or not, but hopefully make decisions quickly so that they get good care. But that is a challenge, and especially in a beautiful state like Wisconsin, where a lot of people live very far away from a close hospital, just that time to get to medical care, you know, is can be a problem for stroke. So we're trying to, you know, come up with better systems of care to address that need.
Yeah. Okay, and let's go on to Pete, and he's in Wales today. Hi, Pete. What's your question?
Thank you. First of all, for having the program. I had a stroke in December of 2017, and I had a pacemaker placed in my chest in early December of 2017, and 8 days later, I had a stroke. Is there any connection? And if there is, what is it?
So, when a pacemaker is placed, it really depends on what kind of pacemaker and where in the heart they're placing those leads, what they call them, the little wires that go into the heart to help, keep the electrical function of the heart working as it should. And when that's a hard question to answer, because there is a risk of stroke with those kinds of procedures, because they're putting, catheters and wires, through those arteries and the veins and to getting around the heart. And then the first after the blood leaves the heart, one of the first kind of takeoff that goes to is up into the brain. And so if there are any little debris or bits of something that comes off during that procedure, it could potentially go to the brain. But, the other complicating thing is that people who need pacemakers, they have heart problems. That's why they're getting the pacemaker placed. And heart problems can lead to stroke. And so is it related to the procedure, or is it, just part of the function of the heart and what's happening? It can often be impossible to really sort it out. Sometimes I'll tell my patients, if I could go back in time and look inside your blood vessels and see what's happening while you had your stroke, I'd have a lot more answers. But in cases like this, we say, well, your pacemaker was necessary to keep your heart healthy. And so in the long run, I would expect that your stroke risk may go down because of the pacemaker. But there's a lot of procedures and surgeries that people can get where there is a risk of stroke with that. And a lot of the times we just have to accept that risk and try and work with it because you need, that procedure or that surgery done. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to say. And at the end of the day, it's really hard for me to know for sure if it was directly related or not. But in the long run, I hope your heart is stronger as a result of the pacemaker and safer from a stroke standpoint.
Okay. Thank you, Pete. excuse me. As far as treatments go, once the initial treatment is done, what comes after that? I mean, what can patients expect?
Yeah, so very often they're admitted to the hospital. In fact, almost always now they're admitted to the hospital. And we have a whole stroke team of nurses, therapists, both occupational, physical, speech, language therapists, swallow therapists, who will, depending on what problems the patient is having, help them with that and start to recover from that stroke. So you get physical, occupational therapy. We have, and they'll also help determine if any rehab is needed after the hospitalization. So you might get discharged to a rehab hospital for more aggressive care, or if you have very mild symptoms, you might be able to go home and get outpatient therapy. It really depends on how bad the stroke is. And then, of course, we look at all of the medicines that you're taking and make sure that we're doing the best we can to prevent another stroke. Sometimes people maybe have a bad buildup of cholesterol in their neck artery called the carotid artery, and that is a risk factor for stroke. So we may actually call the surgeons to come and address that to try and repair it and make it so that the stroke risk is lower. And that can even happen that same hospitalization. But once the acute treatment is done, then the focus is on recovery and prevention. And so there's a lot of different ways that we can do that. But hopefully you leave the hospital with a much lower stroke risk than when you showed up.
Okay. Let's go back to the phone. We have Bill in Rhinelander who has something to talk about. Hey, Bill.
Hello. In 2012, I was suffering the onslaught of a stroke, and I went to our hospital up here in Rhinelander, and lo and behold, to me, I didn't realize it, but when I went in there, they diagnosed it that way. They threw me into for a CAT scan, and I went into the room, and they turned two television sets around, and I was Marshfield Clinic's first telestroke patient. And I'll tell you, to have two of the top-notch neurologists, they were my primary caregivers from that moment on. I can see our emergency room staff just relax. I took the TPA that they recommended, and they transported me to Marshfield. About halfway there, the clot passed through. I mean, I had terrible.
Bill, we're getting a little bit of wind noise there. So I think he had mentioned that the program might have been dropped. Is that?
Yeah. And so what telestroke is, I'm glad it came up because it's important to talk about. We were just talking about how in rural hospitals, a lot of the times the acute stroke care is maybe not as strong there because they don't see as many strokes. They just don't have the resources. And so, and there's not enough people with my kind of training, the vascular neurology stroke specialty training, out there practicing right now. And so what we have, and we've set this up at UW, we have a program and there are various other ones throughout the state and the nation where it's called telestroke. And what that means is that if someone shows up to a small emergency department or even a larger one, but they don't have a stroke specialist on hand, they can do a video visit. So they'll call me, for example, from some of our telestroke sites. And if a patient is there that I need to look at and help examine, they'll actually have, it's sort of like a webcam setup where they'll wheel a cart into the room. I can see the patient and the patient can see me, and I can do an exam sort of via video and help the doctors at that local emergency department decide about whether to give that clot-busting medicine, for example, or whether they need to get a transfer to our hospital for more aggressive surgical treatment, and really try and provide my training and you know, my experience to those local hospitals out in rural areas. And so, and you know, these things, They, you know, all the programs in Wisconsin are sort of trying to grow and expand and find the right way to get to as many hospitals as we can. So I hope that, you know, in Rhinelander and other areas all over the state that we can really establish good care from not just UW, but from, again, a lot of different providers and excellent telestroke systems. So that's what happens. So if you show up in a small hospital and you have stroke symptoms, they might wheel a camera in there with a cart, and you can talk to a doctor far away who can help make the fast decisions they need to for stroke.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing, that availability. Let's go to Stacy in Platteville. Hi, Stacy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I had a question. I'm currently 52 years old, and my grandmother had her first stroke at age 54, had several after that. It was kind of a unique kind of stroke. Apparently, she had to be taken to Mayo Hospital for treatment. I'm still in the process of trying to get her records, but having no luck. My mom is 84 and has not had any strokes, symptoms, or anything like that. I'm wondering about the risk for me or what that could have been in my grandma's case. I know it's hard to tell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are certain conditions that are inherited in families that run, you know, in families that can increase the risk of stroke. It may be hard to get the – so if your grandmother was 54, that must have been – I'm trying to just guess now.
Long time ago,
you know. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised – and, you know, because our – understanding and our experience with stroke is so much more is so much deeper now than it was not even that long ago. Like Mary was talking about earlier, mm-hmm. even just 15 years ago, it was so much different. But you know, I think that some of the more common reasons that there's strokes in families are blood clotting problems, and so sometimes people have genetic reasons that their blood clots a little too easily, and that can lead to stroke. Generally, though, if you're 52 now and you have not had any blood clotting problems in your life so far, that may not be a very high risk. But I think it would be helpful if you could understand a little bit more about your grandmother's stroke and what happened, to talk with your doctors and see if there is anything that might need to look out for. By and large, though, it's a rare case where there's a strong family trait that causes stroke, and that in fact the risk factors of high blood pressure, cholesterol, smoking, excessive alcohol use, diabetes, all these other things that are very common, you know, also, you know, increase the risk of stroke. And so it's not necessarily an inherited problem, but you know, if you're experiencing any of those risk factors, then your stroke risk may also, you know, be high. But that was a long time ago. I wouldn't be surprised if now, you know, particularly with the good primary prevention, that if you're seeing your doctor on a regular basis and they're watching your blood pressure, your risk for stroke is almost certainly much less than your grandmother's was.
Okay. Thank you very much, Stacy. And we had Aaron email, can stress with its inflammation cause a stroke?
That's an excellent but tough question to answer.
Sure.
Right now. There's a lot more research and a better understanding of how mental health and physical health are always tied together. And so stress, you know, can raise the blood pressure, for example, and it can make people at a higher risk of stroke because of that. There are also, though, sometimes acute neurological problems people have that are related to their mental health and stress reasons that aren't related to stroke, but they can look very much like a stroke. But I think it's important, you know, now as a provider, I try and think on all my patients, not just about their physical health, but I try and pay attention to their mental health as well. And, you know, after stroke, a lot of people suffer from depression and anxiety, and making sure that we treat the whole patient that way. But we don't know right now, besides things like blood pressure, and sometimes people under a lot of stress also pick up their smoking a little bit more. You know, so there are a lot of reasons that people under stress can be at a higher risk for stroke. And so it's really important, again, to treat your mental health like you do your physical health and really take care of yourself.
Okay, great. And Nikki, are there other support programs that you have besides the camp?
Yeah, we have a few stroke support groups in the city, actually. UW Health does a stroke support group on the third Thursday of the month. It's actually coming up this week. We offer it at one of our clinics that's between Park and Fish Hatchery. So we offer that monthly. And then there's also a stroke support group out at UW Health Rehab Hospital. And so they offer one, which is kind of nice in that there's a couple of different places to go. And then Meritor Health actually also does a support group at a different time of the month as well. So a variety of different places and times that you can go and work it into what works for your lifestyle. But it's a great opportunity to go and speak with other stroke survivors and brain injury survivors and really share your story and just get a lot of support in that way.
It's nice to know you're not the only one.
Yeah.
And I'm sure anybody could speak to their local hospital and find where the nearest support group would be. And before we sign off, Dr. Bradbury, one more time, what are the signs of a stroke?
Remember, be fast. Balance, eyes, face weakness, you know, trouble with slurring your speech. Arm strength, if you have weakness in one arm or the other, speech, slurring your words or don't get the right words out, and then time to call 911. So be fast. And if you look, really, if you just Google be fast stroke symptoms, that'll be a great way to see them again. But then at the end of the day, if you're worried about a stroke, even if they don't fit that, come get checked out and we'll take a look at it.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
We have been talking with Dr. Luke Bradbury, a stroke neurologist at UW Health, and Nikki Bennett, the stroke program coordinator at UW Health. Up next, we're going to hear from the author of the new book in the Dave Kubiak Door County Mystery Series. So stay with us on the Ideas Network.